This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
I mean, I've always loved maps, and that was my first island journeys were kind of vicarious ones through the pages of atlases. And I love the way that old maps show us the ways that islands have been imagined over centuries.
I confess to having a somewhat ambivalent relationship with islands. Part of me really likes islands. I like stepping off a boat and onto an island, and the pace of life very often just seems to slow down. I like the fact there are parameters, that, you know, there are edges to things. What I don't think I would like, what I don't think I could cope with on a day-to-day basis, is the lack of privacy, that sense of being in a goldfish bowl, of everybody knowing your business. I'm Mark Stephen, and with me is Helen Needham. The person we're speaking to in this edition is Gavin Francis. He's a GP, a doctor, and a writer. He's spent much of his adult life travelling to, working and living on islands. And in his latest book, Island Dreams, Mapping an Obsession, he describes those places and the wider cultural fascination with them. Gavin joins us now from his home in Edinburgh. I was down in Fife last week, down in Pittenweem on Friday, and it was a beautiful morning, and the Forth was absolutely, you know, just like beaten silver. And sitting there, you know, just bang smack in the middle of it, in all this light, was this dark shape, the island of Mey. Now, that's got a particular significance for you.
That's right. I grew up in the west of Fife, and when I was a wee boy, quite a lot of my holidays were to Caravan Park in the East Nuke. And I used to lie there in the caravan awning that didn't have any curtains and watch the lighthouse on the Isle of Mey, spend hours and hours on the beach. And as you say, whenever you're on the East Nuke, you look up, you see it dominating the horizon. And I dreamed of getting there one day, but it was years and years until I actually made it there.
It must be 20, 25 years ago I was across there. And the back of the island, the bit that normally very few people actually see unless you go to the island itself. There's a harbour there. Once upon a time, it was a very, very busy trading point. And I was talking to the then archaeologist for Fife, who was a guy called Peter Yeoman, and they just excavated all these skeletons, including one that had a scallop shell in its mouth. Explain the significance of the scallop shell.
I think, like a lot of people, when I first read about this scallop in the mouth of a man in his 20s, who was presumed to be either a monk, or it could have possibly been some kind of a pilgrim, we assumed that it was a sign that he'd been on the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela, the symbol of which is a scallop shell. And like a lot of people, I assumed, oh, how amazing, there's a young man who's been buried on the Isle of Mey, who's actually made the pilgrimage in the Middle Ages to Santiago. But apparently, according to Peter and to other experts in this area, the fact that, first of all, the scallop was found in the man's mouth rather than on his breast suggests that it wasn't so much a symbol of pilgrimage. And also, it was the wrong side of the scallop. Apparently, it's the flat side of the scallop that the pilgrims use, whereas it was the concave side that was in the man's mouth. And so the experts say that actually the scallop was in his mouth as a kind of final sacrament. It was often put in by some communities, they would place something like a scallop into the mouth of the deceased as some kind of blessing rather than as a symbol of a pilgrimage made in life.
Just to explain the geography of the Isle of May, it's basically just offshore from Edinburgh by about, you know, probably about 10 miles, something like that. But the point is, if you were trying to evade customs, you could come on the Isle of May, offload in the Isle of May, and then arrange for a smaller boat to actually take it onto the shore. I said to Peter, you know, because we were sitting in brilliant sunshine, and you're just looking out on the North Sea, next stop Holland. I said, you know, what would this have looked like in medieval times? And he said, a forest of masts. And they would have been from all over, you know, the sort of the Hanseatic trading partners. Says, you know, we were better connected in medieval times through the Isle of May than we are now.
Mm. Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And if you troll through the maps on the National Library of Scotland website, you can see that many of the most spectacular maps of the late medieval, early modern period, they're Dutch maps, because that part of the world was constantly sailing up and down the east coast of the British Isles. And so that whole coast was very well known to not just the Hanseatics, but the Dutch.
It's also a place now, really, which is valued and celebrated for the bird life. And you actually ended up spending a month there as a warden. What did that involve?
Well, it was a time in my life when I was a very hectic junior doctor job where I wasn't getting much sleep and was losing a lot of weight. And I realised that what I needed was some kind of rest and recuperation. And so while still at the hospital job in the Western General in Edinburgh, I wrote to the warden on the island, the chief warden, and asked if they had room for a volunteer. And he said, yeah, by all means. And so I went out, I was involved, I was helping ring the birds, I was doing a lot of maintenance, you know, path maintenance. I was painting things and clearing bits of rubbish from the place. I was digging out the old medieval well. I was involved in doing a lot of the counts, helping the scientists from the Centre for Ecology and Hydrology, who count the birds every year and keep an eye on all the changes that are happening in the different bird populations. So, yeah, all sorts of things.
And how did that experience change your perception of that island?
I suppose as a child, I'd looked at it as an imagined place. I was a keen member of the Young Ornithologists Club, and I knew that it was a bird reserve there, and I wanted to visit it for those reasons. So in many ways, it was the fulfilment of a kind of dream. But also living there gave me a little bit of a sense of what it must have been like for the lighthouse keepers who lived on that island for many, many decades. And before that, a glimpse of what Mark's talking about, the many centuries when it was a monastic centre and it was a real central linchpin of communications in the Forth. One of the lovely things about being a warden there is you get to introduce people to the island who come over on the boat from Anstruther, the tourist boat, but they're there for a couple of hours and then you get the island to yourself for the next 22 hours. There's a real beauty to that time, living in a place that almost no other human beings, just thousands and thousands and thousands of birds. There's a kind of timelessness to it. I mean, I've always loved maps, and that was my first island journeys were kind of vicarious ones through the pages of atlases. And I love the way that old maps show us the ways that islands have been imagined over centuries. So, you know, it's a good example you just brought up, the Hanseatics and the Dutch. And looking at those old maps gives us a sense of how important that coast was to these traders centuries and centuries ago. Maps give us the opportunity to explore somewhere from our own sitting room, but they also give us the opportunity to explore not just through space but through time and look at the different priorities of different ages of people. Cartographers know that to isolate and distill the features of a portion of the Earth's surface in all its inexpressible complexity is to exert power over it. But it could be said that maps offer only the illusion of understanding a landscape. Rebecca Solnit wrote, However beautiful, with their ships and dragons, those old maps were tools of empire and capital. Science is how capitalism knows the world, a friend remarks to me, and the distinctions and details these maps marked out were first of all for merchants and military expeditions. What was marked terra incognita was always what remained unvanquished. What really struck me when looking out some of these maps is I would find an old Spanish or Dutch colonial map from the 16th century. And then in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., there's a huge, huge treasure trove of CIA maps freely available to anybody. And you'd find the CIA map of the same place and it would have the same framing, the same approach. It was almost identical in every way across the span of 300 or 400 years. And so I think that's what Rebecca Solnit is getting at. Similarly, when I came to Mount Athos, you can see these beautiful maps created by the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the late 19th century of the Greek coastline. And yeah, they're all pointing towards what Rebecca Solnit said was, you know, these maps are being marked out for merchants and military expeditions to understand exactly what they're approaching when they're approaching with troops.
I'd like to talk about Africa now, because you spent time in Kenya working in a hospital, and then after that, you journeyed to the island of Lamu. This, for me, really illustrated how an island can have such a different rhythm from somewhere even quite close to it.
I mean, the coast of East Africa is really fascinating culturally, because the coastline was culturally Islamic, and Islamic traders and Islamic missionaries were very busy up and down the coasts. But inland was much more, especially the last couple of centuries, much more dominated by the British, by Christian missionaries and so on. Yeah, I found that transition from the mainland out to the island of Lamu, which is just offshore into the Indian Ocean, just extraordinary. There was a suddenly very different feel to the towns and the villages. There was suddenly a much gentler flow of people. There was I think it was the Islamic culture just subtly inflecting every aspect of life more strongly than it was on the coast. And that was one of the really obvious examples to me of how an island, even very close offshore, can have a completely different culture from that mainland.
But then you move to another island in a lake and a completely different experience, because someone you met there absolutely hated it.
Yeah, that was an island in an inland lake. So culturally, yeah, it was culturally it belonged to not to the coast, not to transient kind of traders, but to a settled culture. It was a useful reminder for me that a place, this was a national nature reserve island in a lake, and even a place which seemed to me so idyllic can feel like a prison to somebody who's unfulfilled or unhappy there. And it was a real reminder of that distinction and attention that I try to draw in the book, that many people seek out islands to find peace, but they also seek out islands to use them as prisons. And we use islands as prisons all the time, you know, from Rikers Island or Alcatraz or the Bass Rock. Islands are often used as prisons, but they're also used by anchorites and pilgrims as places to find peace and freedom from distraction. And I wanted to draw out and think about much more closely the similarities and the differences between those two different aims.
After the African journey, you came back to Scotland and almost immediately headed north to Bergen and the Lofoten Islands of Norway. Can I get you to read that section of the book?
The slopes of the Lofoten Mountains were carpeted in a thick moss that moulded itself around my body as I slept. The tensions of those African journeys dissolved. We climbed a mountain overlooking the original Maelstrom, a tidal whirlpool between two of the islands. My sleep was interrupted by the croaking of ravens. About midnight one night, I was woken by Claire to see an aurora borealis. The lights were just beginning, a small flame of grey haze against the night. And from the cliff top, we watched them multiply, columns of green conjured from nothing, only to flourish and then evanesce. A wash of swirling luminescence rose and fell like marbled endpapers spread over the book of the sea, and meteorites flashed through the ionosphere. At one moment, standing high on the island's ridge, I was surrounded on all sides by vertical pillars of grey-green light stretching up to infinity. Sometimes the flames came quickly, but more often they moved imperceptibly, so that as I turned my attention away from one part of the horizon and back, I hadn't noticed any movement, but the scene had changed. I sat up watching the lights until the filament of crimson along the northern horizon fattened to a dull dawn. More light rose from the horizon in chromatography columns, dissolving the aurora into the gathering day.
You were talking about islands as prisons and islands as places of refuge too. Islands as therapy, a place where you can start listening to yourself. And the reason I say that, again, thinking in terms of the aurora borealis and everything else and the silence, someone's once described prayer to me as not speaking to God but listening.
Sarah Maitland, who lives in Dumfriesshire, wrote a lovely book about silence, and she describes that very intense silence where she started almost to hear these two tones, almost like she could hear the workings of her own cardiovascular system as a low tone and her own nervous system as a high tone. John Cage talks about this as well when he did those performance pieces that were essentially silence, about how we have to learn to listen more closely to our own inner rhythms, and maybe that is a kind of prayer.
You mentioned already islands as prisons. Something that really struck me was your description of the Andaman Islands of India, really because of the shocking history of that place. But now it seemed, from the way that you described them and the experience that you had there, like a paradise.
The Andaman Islands are stunningly beautiful. You know, they're kind of picture postcard renditions of the Western fantasy of the tropical island. You know, these glorious yellow beaches and this translucent, utterly translucent turquoise water, palm trees, and so on. And I travelled there. I was on a round-the-world journey with my wife. We were on a motorcycle from Scotland to New Zealand. And we went across the Bay of Bengal. We went from Tamil Nadu to the Andamans and from there on to Southeast Asia. The Andaman Islands were just like a complete revelation to me that such a paradisical place could exist. But under the British Raj, they were a prison for dissidents. And there was many thousands of people were killed there. And one corner of the island, was given over to a museum which showed the old penitentiary, where they still have the gallows there, where they used to hang people three at a time. And so it was the most extraordinary contrast, conflict, if you like, provoking this kind of cognitive dissonance, where you're in this place where people would pay to go and have a relaxing holiday, but it's also a place in which there was many, many horrors were unleashed there.
You said earlier that, you know, you spent time working in Antarctica. But what you didn't say was you actually took a ship all the way there via the Falkland Islands. Now, again, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. Interesting that the British military regard the Falklands as a hardship posting.
I think some of them do, yeah, absolutely. Quite a few of the ones that I met when I was in the Falkland, in Stanley, certainly hated it, yeah.
Strange though, isn't it?
But I really liked it. I thought they were beautiful, yeah. The beaches are just extraordinary. You know, it's like Luskintyre Beach all the way around. And they have that whole thing of the Antipodean wildlife has no fear of humans. So you're sitting on the beach watching the waves and king penguins just come right up to you, waddle past you. The dolphins, you know, Magellanic dolphins are bounding through the water just a few inches away. It's like an opportunity of seeing what I alluded to earlier, that world emptied of the human. because there's so few people there and they're all concentrated around Stanley, or mostly around Stanley. On our approach to South Georgia, the ship pushed through bands of fog and sunshine, the seas around the ship's hull teeming with life. Fur seals somersaulted through the water. Sooty, wandering and black-browed albatrosses swooped in the ship's wake. The waves frothed with giant petrels, cape petrels and penguins. From the ship I took a small boat, a tender, to be met on a jetty by scientists who lived year-round on Bird Island, a splinter of rock off South Georgia's western cape. They handed me a broom-handle seal bodger, with which I was to beat off any fur seals that approached with their fangs bared. Black-browed albatrosses nested among the slopes up along the tussock grass, and up on the plateau I tiptoed, awestruck, between the nests of wandering albatrosses. These immense birds, larger than swans and with a 12-foot wingspan, were untroubled by my presence, marvellous in their serenity.
I have a technical question to ask about that. Is a broom handle a sufficient bodger to deter a fur seal?
Yes, it is. I think there's
There you go.
A lot of permanent residents on Bird Island would attest to this. You know, that the broom handle has saved many of them from a vicious bite. They have quite nasty bite, yeah. Lots of nasty bacteria living on a fur seal's teeth.
You stayed in Antarctica for 14 months. You've actually written a book about that experience. The thing I was interested to read about is the effect of overwintering in Antarctica on the human brain.
There's a colossal body of psychology, neuropsychology research on what are known as isolated and confined environments, usually taken to mean saturation divers in the North Sea or polar research stations. And these are places that are studied often by NASA for preparation for an eventual mission to Mars, where people might have to be cooped up in a very tiny environment for years at a time. And so there's been a lot of research done into the effect on the minds and brains of this kind of isolation. And it's extraordinary to learn that it's normal, for example, for your brainwave patterns to change after a year of isolation somewhere like Antarctica. And also they've found a really interesting correlation with the fact that people who've had that kind of experience, often it benefits their physical and their psychological health later on. They seem to find that people who've been through that kind of isolation and adversity at a certain time in their life use it as a resource to draw on later in their life. And that was a kind of reassuring psychology finding for me to read about.
I wonder actually how skewed that research would be, though. Is it a self-selecting sample? You're not going to get fidgets going to Antarctica, for goodness sake, you know.
One of the psychology papers that I read said exactly that. It said that the experience seemed to induce already calm, self-assured individuals to become even more so.
How did it affect you? Did you feel different?
I think different ways. So short term, in my first few months I got back, I was very unsettled because it's such a change. So you've gone from this life which is very elemental, very silent, where there's very little asked of you beyond a certain set of parameters, quite narrow parameters, and you go back to all the kind of hurly-burly chaos of city life and medical training as I was doing at the time. So in that point of view, that was quite a difficult adjustment. And that's the tension between remoteness and the city, between community and that kind of extreme isolation that I try and draw out in the book. But on the other hand, there was also the longer term effects. And I do understand what those psychologists were getting at when they say that it can, that kind of experience can become a resource for you to draw on through later life. Because when you meet adversity again in the future, you think, well, I got through that and I handled that reasonably, and therefore I can probably handle this. So I think there's a grain of truth in that.
Lockdown being a prime example, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. And although I feel a bit guilty talking about look, because of my job as a GP, I've had to continue going through work throughout. So lockdown has affected me differently. Obviously, it's been difficult medical work over these last few months. Very, very difficult. But at the same time, I have been able to keep going to the office, keep going to my workplace, keep trying to do the things I normally do.
You mentioned Athos in Greece, which is I've never been there, but from what you know, just reading in your book, it seems frozen in time.
Like a fortress, the monastery of Iveron lay banked into the hillside, high and grey. Its tiny windows were archers' slots. The building was 1,000 years old. Its cobbled track felt rutted with history. It led to a wide courtyard enclosed by open, iron-cased doors. I was greeted in the Archon Tariki, the pilgrim's reception, by a quiet monk with an Australian accent who exchanged pleasantries in English about my hospital work. He offered me Turkish delight, claimed as a cultural tradition of both Greeks and Turks, and a reminder that for much of the last 500 years, the Athos Peninsula was under Ottoman rule. The office of Vespers was about to begin. I was expected to attend, but was asked, as an unbeliever, to stand outside the church. A fat monk told me to turn my back so that I couldn't see the others at prayer. For 2 hours I stood in the half-light, listening to the monks' chants and responses. Dinner was a bowl of rice with cauliflower stew. The candles in the dormitory were extinguished at 7 p.m. It's said that for 1,000 years there have been no women permitted on Athos. There's no radio or television. Prayer is obligatory between 3 and 5 times a day. The monks eat simple food. They have no money.
Some folk, I think, would think that was a recipe for absolute happiness. And others, and I'm one of them, would just see it as being a recipe for tipping me right into a rubber room. There's no way I couldn't cope with that.
I mean, it's a lovely tradition that they have in the Greek Orthodox Church that people go to Athos, men go to Athos, and there are equivalent places that women go to. They just have a time out, so they go for a week. There was all sorts of other people that I met in these pilgrims' quarters, who are mostly Greeks, mostly who come every year or every other year for a week, to have that experience of time out of their life, out of their normal hectic schedule. They find that a week of that kind of isolation every so often gives them a sense of well-being. It grounds them in some way. And I think there's value in that. You know, it's a tradition that in the West we used to have as part of Christian tradition, but it's much less so these days. I enjoyed the fact that this is such an ancient tradition that obviously speaks to something deep in human psychology that people seek. Speaking to one of the monks, I remember telling him exactly what you just said. Like, I could not live like this. No way could I live like this all the time. And he said, well, I tried living in the world, but I couldn't live the way I wanted to with the right kind of attention and care and, for him, prayer. In the world, and this was the only way I could do it, by taking myself off to this peninsula where I have no other kinds of distractions.
Let's move to Orkney now, and you've got a lovely Edwin Muir quote, which is, I was born before the Industrial Revolution and am now about 200 years old. In 1751, I set out from Orkney to Glasgow. When I arrived, I found that it was not 1751, but 1901. I just love that because it just shows that Orkney is living in a different time zone in a way. What's the appeal of Orkney for you?
I love Orkney now for so many reasons. I used to work there as a GP because I have a lot of friends there, because I have a kind of fascination for the mix that it has of being its own centre with its own metropolises of Kirkwall and Stromness, where the world beyond Orkney seems to fall away and seem of less importance or relevance, but also has that easy access to the feeling of being in a world kind of emptied of the human, a world that's far more simple and elemental. It's very easy when you're in the West Mainland of Orkney to go for a walk out to the Broch of Bursay, for example, and watch the seabirds and feel that there's almost nothing of the human in the world and the horizons that you're seeing. But at the same time, the communities of Stromness and Kirkwall to me are very special, very strong, very powerful places.
Just to the south of the Broch of Bursay, we've got friends who live in Evie. They look out their kitchen window and, you know, you can see the tide race underneath and things. You're not just looking at that, you are looking at 5,000 years of history. It's just, it is full. You know, if we stick a spade in the ground anywhere in Orkney, you're going to hit an archaeological site.
Yeah, it's really special, that particular bit as well, around the Broch of Gurness, where you look out on Ainhallow and the tidal race coming through Ainhallow Sound is like, you can see a level on the water, it's
yes,
moving so fast.
It's a step.
You can see the water falling down a staircase, yeah.
There is a huge difference, though, between living and working on an island and just visiting. I mean, I started this by saying I'm not sure I could live on an island because of the lack of privacy. But, you know, that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is you are never disconnected on an island community or in an island community.
There's a tension that kind of animates this book, I think, between island and city in the broadest or most extreme sense. But there's also a paradox that animates it, which is that in the city it's very easy to become isolated and lonely, and when you've got almost limitless opportunities for human engagement, it's very easy to let it all slip through your fingers and fail to connect with anyone. Whereas on an island, a small island community, those kinds of connections are what sustain life there, and they're essential, and they become very much stronger as a consequence, I think, than they do in the city. So it's a strange paradox.
We spoke about that by a chap on the Isle of May, you know, who was found with a scallop shell in his mouth. Is that the essence of pilgrimage then, this connection between isolation and connectedness? Just connecting to something different.
When people go on pilgrimage, whether it's to the Isle of May or whether it's to Santiago or whether it's to Mount Athos, what they're doing is they're trying to cut themselves off from everything that's familiar and everything that has caused perhaps a particularly agitated state of mind. And they're trying to seek something different. And, you know, for some people, that pilgrimage could be to the centre of a city, like Santiago de Compostela or to Jerusalem or Varanasi or wherever you want to choose as your pilgrimage destination. But for other people, you know, like the great medieval tradition of Irish monks, you know, places of pilgrimage were exactly what we've been discussing, places that were filled with a kind of silence and an elemental, natural rhythm that seemed to empty themselves of human influence. I can see the appeal of both, the allure of both those different types of pilgrimage, but what they have in common is separating yourself from what's familiar in order to put yourself in a different and hopefully an uplifting or transformative state of mind.
For me, that's the thing that I miss the most, actually, in the circumstances that we are living in, is that possibility and the opportunity to put yourself in that place.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it's really, we're in a very difficult stage just now. And I think, you know, as a doctor, I've spent 20 years trying to encourage people, for the sake of their own mental health, to socialise more and to get more involved in community groups and, you know, to meet others if they're suffering from various kinds of addictions, or to join more kind of enthusiastic amateur groups if they're getting lonely. And all that's been stopped now. And so what we're really seeing is that people are losing... They're losing a lot of what used to be their coping strategies and their coping mechanisms for the difficulties of life. And I really hope that when government is formulating its strategies about trying to reduce COVID spread, that it takes that into account, that people are losing their normal coping strategies and we have to try and find new ones.
How about you? I mean, you know, reading through this book, I get the sense that visiting islands on a fairly regular basis has been part of your coping strategy. You can't do it anymore. You're stuck in the middle of Edinburgh. So, I mean, how are you coping?
Well, you know, I feel somewhat guilty, but actually I have been, you know, doing things. So I've been going up to Orkney and doing locums up there, for example. So I'll go up and be the GP on an island for a week. And because I'm fulfilling an essential role on that island, I'm still allowed to travel. So in a way, I have still been making some...
You've been cheating.
yeah, somewhat. I got the ferry over from Scrabster to Stromness to take up one of these locum posts. And there was, you know, that gigantic ferry that sails from Scrabster. There was four other cars on it. And I was thinking, who are these three other people? You know, is it the guy from
They're
the
all
passport,
GPs.
The electric board, the water board? Yeah. I'm not sure who was making that journey, but yes. But you're quite right. You know, I can't do anything, any of the kind of journeys that I used to be able to do, and like everyone else, I'm just trying to find workarounds, fudges, compromises, ways of trying to get some fresh air into our imaginations through this, because it's going to go on for a few months yet, I'm afraid to say.
Your book's a very good way of doing that. Gavin.
Ah, thanks.
Well, it is. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
No, I really enjoyed it too. Gavin Francis's book, Island Dreams, Mapping and Obsession, is published by Canongate. Get in touch and tell us what you think of this podcast and where you listen. We do like hearing from you. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, we think you'll enjoy another podcast made by our colleagues here at BBC Radio Scotland. It's called Time Travels and it's coming shortly. Here's Susan Morrison to explain a bit more about it.
Time Travels is the Scottish history podcast where we like to zip through the centuries, exploring the lives of ordinary and extraordinary people.
Oh, let me tell you about the sins of the tongue. In Falkirk, Sessions records have someone being called thief, devil, luckenbrowit witch. It's another way of saying monobrow. Yeah, Kikodi, some unfortunate person is called an evil-faced, men-sworn dog. This one's a real doozy from Ellen. Fiery dragon, yellow gelding, old limp, fashioned harlot, serpent whom the devil had begotten.
Wow.
From myself, Mark Stephen, from Helen Needham, and of course, GP and author Gavin Francis. Thanks for listening.